This is your Uncle Don back again on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George with the 318th edition of the Porcupine Petting Zoo. We're supposed to celebrate the coming of cashless society. Soon, we're told, coins and bills will be useless items of curiosity value only. Already we can pay for gasoline by pointing a keychain gizmo at the pump. Visa and MasterCard are coming up with a way of combining the functions of credit and debit in a single card. New cards, now with personal information on a chip, may be made obsolete by smart cell phones able to siphon your bank account with a wave at a reader. Before breaking out the champagne, who wins and who loses as we move into virtual money? There are manufacturers overseas, of course, who make those readers, cell phones, and related electronics. Sellers of the machines to retailers get a cut. Banks, which will process the movement of imaginary money from your account to the retailers, will get their small fee. Telephone companies providing lines between seller and bank get their rent. Investigators who assemble personal information gain. And who loses? The retailer loses as he has to pay for that telephone line, electronic equipment, and fees to the bank. These fixed and variable costs will drive some small volume marginal businesses to bankruptcy. Businesses operating in gray areas of the cash economy will be forced out if they cannot conform to the cashless pattern. Forget flea markets, farmers markets, and garage sales. Restaurant servers and others surviving on cash tips will lose. Already, some restaurants scoop tips added to credit card bills, using them to top up wages below the legal minimum. And finally, customers will all lose, as those expenses are added to retail prices. We sacrifice any anonymity of transactions if every expenditure is recorded and available for scrutiny. Cash purchases are the last bastion of privacy in economic relations. We already leave a readable trail as we use checks, credit and debit cards, and those cute little keychain thingamabobs. Add to that affinity cards we use to accumulate points with the Bay, Petro-Canada, Save-On-Foods, Shoppers Drug Mart, and most airlines. Movement to a cashless society will close that annoying little gap in our government's goal of perfect knowledge of our every transaction. Do I sound paranoid? Look at the way they're already closing in on us. Have you bought a money order recently? I wanted to buy a U.S. postal money order for a magazine subscription the other day. Who's it to be made out to? Asked the minimum wage clerk at the scab outlet at the back of a drug-cum-hardware store. Just leave it blank, replied I. Oh, we have to fill in the recipient, says she. Why, says I. It's now the law to prevent money laundering, says she. I became irrational. The government of Canada is afraid that I may be laundering 38 Yankee dollars? Nuts. I still intend to subscribe to that worthy publication, but I'll send my order accompanied with a pair of U.S. $20 bills and take my chances. I was reading an article in India when reminded of the day when I came close to becoming a permanent resident of that country. Land borders of Burma were closed in the 70s, so it was necessary for travelers on the Gringo Trail to fly from Thailand to Nepal. It was on one of those flights with Thai International Airlines when a mechanical problem forced us to land in Calcutta. The airline did a fine job of handling the situation, arranging for passengers to spend the night in the Oberoi Grand Hotel, an old colonial building whose grandeur was largely in its name. The next morning, we were transported to the airport to resume our journey. In those days, there were definite bureaucratic procedures involved in leaving India. An official questioned me as to name, passport number, and such until he came to home address. I replied, none. I explained that I was homeless while traveling. Where do you receive your mail? He cleverly asked. American Express, wherever I land. Where do your parents live? That's irrelevant as I am an independent adult. I need an address or you can't leave. Okay, what's the address of this airport? That would not do. It was a standoff. I would not fabricate an address, and the flunky would not let me proceed with a dreaded blank space in the official form. At this point, the shepherd assigned by the airline intervened with the bureaucrat holding a conversation aside, after which I was allowed to board the plane. I'll never know what address I acquired that day. I trust it still resides in molding files somewhere in Calcutta. Bad news. Canada lost another independent newspaper. This was the Republic of East Vancouver, a feisty little biweekly publication of just 8 pages. This one-man operation has been a freebie in Vancouver, but I paid for a mail subscription. With his early June edition, the owner-publisher, Kevin Pogfin, threw in the towel. After 9 years of running a shoestring operation, he's tired. This comes on the heels of Kevin's losing his independent Vancouver bookstore, specializing in obscure magazines and books which were seldom found elsewhere. That business fell victim to a new Chapters megastore in his neighborhood. Kevin has been unstinting in defending what he thinks is right, while opposing foolishness, stupidity, graft, and wrongdoing. I found his material, and that of writers he chose to print, lean toward the negative. That's not surprising, as there is more to criticize than praise in today's world. He was consistent in reporting on the downside of Vancouver's coming Olympics and the war against Afghanistan. I do hope that Kevin finds that his habitual readers, like me, will prevail upon him to resume his rants in the fall. If his coterie of readers is lucky, he will find that he needs the outlet provided by his paper, like I need mine on the radio. Contained in the Republic's final edition is an article by Michael Nononen entitled "The End Is Nigh," which pretty much explains its theme. The author catalogues some dangers awaiting humanity in the near future. Within this piece are the following two paragraphs worth quoting. In Climate Wars, Random House, Canada, 2008, military historian Gwyn Dyer reviews work being done by military establishments around the world to anticipate the likely events of climate change on our global civilization. Dyer writes that coming decades will see a steep decline in our planet's agricultural productivity, leading to famine and massive dislocation. Sea levels will rise and storm surges may inundate coastal cities like New York and Bombay. Resource wars will likely ensue. Alliance systems and multilateral institutions may shatter as nations turn on one another. The financial and production systems that depend on global integration may also collapse, leading to rapid global economic decline. The wealthiest members of every society will pull away from the rest of the population, producing intensified class warfare. Pestilences and disease that were previously restricted to tropical climates will expand their range while public health infrastructures are decimated by economic chaos leading to ruinous epidemics. Massive social upheavals will produce intense ideological conflict. Authoritarian political and religious ideologies will likely thrive at the expense of social justice, civil liberties, and ecology. Close quote. If Gwyn Dyer is right in his predictions, this could explain some actions of our governments which otherwise seem irrational. Fears of famine and massive dislocations provide strong incentives to fortify borders against hordes of future desperate refugees. Is the United States government really so worried about wetbacks from the south and frostbacks from the north, or is it fortifying borders against anticipated invasions of hungry masses from the third world funneling through our respective countries? Is Canada really so concerned about ships transiting the Northwest Passage as it is of seaborne people smugglers unloading their cargoes on our unprotected northern communities? Armies seem increasingly concerned about quelling disturbances within and preventing migrations from without. Protectionism is increasing as nations strive to be less reliant on vagaries of international supplies vital to their survival. China's in the forefront of those locking in supplies of energy, minerals, and food from other countries. This phenomenon will grow as resources available on free markets contract. The gap between rich and poor within most societies is growing. As the wealthy tend to cluster, often in gated communities, it's easier to visualize where class warfare could develop, with those places becoming armed camps, protecting their residents from invasion by desperate hoi polloi. What is already a feature of many third world societies may be coming to a neighborhood near you. Gwyn predicts a public health crisis. Might this fear be behind the move of Canada's governments, federal and provincial, to dismantle Medicare? If epidemics and pestilence lie in our future, those with money certainly don't intend to wait in line behind the impecunious. They want to buy their way to the head of the line, as they now do in the United States and other backward lands. Look at the big picture instead of the confusing detail, and the future looks grim. Remember when a ceremony was usually a formal happy recognition of a positive event? Forget about it. At least when referring to the ever more frequent ramp ceremonies, when yet another Canadian soldier's corpse is loaded on an aircraft for return to his or her loved ones. I have no doubt that relatives of the deceased and the Afghan invasion supporters aren't the only ones who dislike ramp ceremonies. I recall how much, as a soldier, I hated it when routine was broken by some officer's brainstorm of having a parade or ceremony. Out came the shoe polish, the brasso, and the dress uniforms, so we could stand endlessly or march around in circles to please the cameras and the big shots. I can imagine how much ordinary soldiers enjoy standing in the 50-degree sun as cameras record the departure of another comrade receiving early release from drudgery and danger of a useless war. Think of this when you next look at pictures of an official send-off for a Canadian victim of Harper's War. I have some good news. Seriously, Ferguson Lake is showing signs of revival. This small body of water is the central attraction of the Ferguson Lake Nature Reserve in Prince George, a city-run recreational property. At about 40 acres, the lake isn't big enough to host motorboats, much to the delight of those of us who like to take a canoe, kayak, or raft for a leisurely paddle. This lake has been public for nearly 20 years. We've seen it cleaned up and developed from an attractive nuisance, formerly a magnet for yahoos to party, build bonfires, and wash their monster trucks and other affronts to nature. The city cut a trail around the lake, installing boardwalks, a fishing dock, parking lot, and outhouse. Unfortunately, development has seen a decrease in the population of beavers, muskrats, and waterfowl. Every year in late June, there appeared millions, literally millions, of tadpoles gathering in dense schools. Over a couple of weeks, these tadpoles gradually morphed into tiny toads, which ventured onto the shore until, as though by some understanding, they took off, fanning away from the shores into the woods and fields, many thousands being smashed on the road before reaching safety. In a few days, every one of the millions would disappear, not to be seen for another year. Well, this year, June came and went with no tadpoles. This, coupled with a drop of close to a meter in the lake level, made me fear that the lake ecology had been severely compromised. The beaver dam holding back the lake was breached in the spring and had not been repaired, so I feared that this had affected the toad eggs in some way. But much to my relief, the tadpoles are back, late, I suppose, due to our cold spring. My wife and I took our canoe onto the lake and found the beavers were repairing their dam. As one who is sometimes accused of being negative, I'm pleased to be wrong, as I was in this case. Come check out Ferguson Lake. Bring a boat, fishing pole, or picnic lunch. Just don't bring one of those damned all-terrain vehicles. The Ferguson Lake Nature Reserve is there for all of us, and you don't have to drive all day to get there. Say, remember a provincial election a few short months ago? The promises earning Campbell an unprecedented third term in spite of his terrible record? One of them was a pledge to increase funding for Northern Health by 20%, bringing our services in line with Vancouver's. That was then. This is now, in the time of a new reality. Since our electorate has returned its usual stable of three mediocre right-wing politicians, supposedly representing us, new reality means that a 20% increase has turned into a 2% decrease. But not to worry. Come the next election, we'll be promised a 20% hike, and our voters, short of memory as always, will put three of the same or similar stooges in the legislature to represent us. A poll of Canadians indicates that Barack Obama is more popular than any domestic politician of any party, federal or provincial. A full three-quarters of Canadians think he is doing an excellent or good job as president. Even Albertans support him at 67%. What are we to make of that? On the one hand, there's no Canadian leader about whom I can be enthusiastic. On the other, considering the confluence of disasters Obama has to sort out simultaneously and the entrenched opposition for Republicans and conservative Democrats, he's working miracles. Note, I don't agree with the way he's attempting to rescue the American economy from the top down rather than the bottom up, but I have to admit that he has more information at his fingertips than even I do. I don't agree that rescuing an ailing industry with billions of aid to corporations is a good idea. But certainly the actions of Canada in mimicking the U.S. isn't providing any leadership. He wants to stop torture without prosecuting those in the Bush regime who condoned it. Okay, that would bring on a fight costing him precious support he needs to battle for improved health care. And he can't go straight for single-payer Medicare, as that would alienate yet another powerful industry he needs for other reforms. So it's all a game in which he has to juggle more balls than one could count. If Canadians like Barack so much, more than any of our own leaders, we should be laying track to get him to come to our country. He already said in Ottawa that he loves Canada. He's not without experience in moving around with Kenya and Indonesia in his background. With his experience, he should qualify as a desirable immigrant. I was admitted in 1967 as a landed immigrant after 15 minutes of formalities at the border. And look at me. So that takes care of our end. Now we must be patient until the first, or maybe the second, attempt at his assassination. Some domestic religious fundamentalist terrorist, yes, I said terrorist, will take a shot at him, and, assuming failure, it could just provide an attitude adjustment to a young president who doesn't want to leave a widow. He would certainly be safe from Canada's resident terrorist squad as long as he doesn't perform abortions or come out of the closet on us. So let's get a movement going here to prepare the way for our eventual offer of asylum to Obama. I figure he could slip right into leadership of one of our political parties, any party, and be off and running to put Canada back on a progressive track. What have we to lose? Stephen Harper? This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. One pledge I hope Harper honors is the one to tighten standards on what sellers can call products of Canada. This has always been a slippery concept, as so many things are made with various percentages of imported components. I always wondered at those Volvo cars proudly displaying window decals declaring, "Assembled in Canada." How much assembly was done here? I saw the Volvo plant in Nova Scotia before it was abandoned, and it certainly was not what I would have thought of as a full-scale auto plant. Did they just bring cars in, slap on hubcaps, then call them Canadian-made? How about food? Ever see a package of coffee labeled Product of Canada? As far as I know, we don't grow a lot of coffee here with climate change. We may in the future, but not yet. A recent recall of President's Choice beef products labeled Product of Canada reveals that the meat came from the United States and was processed here, whatever that entailed. With new U.S. stimulus legislation containing Buy American clauses, this works the other way. Steel trusses fabricated in Canada have been prohibited from American infrastructure projects, although the steel itself came from the States. At the very least, there should be a minimum legal threshold before anything can be called Canadian. It would be ridiculous to carry this too far, but certainly 75% of labor and components would not be too much for a threshold. Speaking of Canadian, Tim Hortons is back. Oh, didn't you know it was gone? The bricks, mortar, and coffee are still down the block and never left. But Tim's has been incorporated in the United States, even though it does 90% of its business in our country. It had been a subsidiary of Wendy's, the purveyor of junk food and home of the minimum wage teenager, until it was spun off as an independent entity. So what is with this flip-flopping of nationality? Managers of Tim's will return to Canadian incorporation, not because they like us more than Americans. It's just that our corporate tax rate is lower than theirs. When I think of this, it seems to make no sense. When a company makes a profit in the United States, I would expect it to pay tax on that profit there. When it makes money in Canada, it should pay our taxes, right? So what difference should it make whether their incorporation is here or there? If they can dodge higher taxes in either, why not plant a head office in the British Virgin Islands or the Bahamas and pay no tax at all? There's something smelly in tax laws allowing companies to play one jurisdiction against another, driving down tax rates for both in a race to the bottom. All governments, except in the most outrageous of tax havens, rely on taxes to finance their operations. We should not allow companies which make profits in Canada or the United States to escape their obligations to finance the services which make their operations possible. Stephen Harper may be too busy this summer to follow up on either taxation problems or product labeling. He and his party are softening the public up for the next election, now that he has blatantly violated his own legislation fixing voting dates. This could come about any time the NDP, Liberals, and Bloc can agree to bring the Tory minority down. All summer long, we'll be subjected to an orchestrated campaign of announcements, all aimed at bolstering the Tory image of competence, or at least tearing down that of the opposition. Polls have been taken, focus groups have been milked, all in the quest of influencing wavering opinions of the great unwashed masses. The main target will be Ignatieff. He'll continue to be attacked for his intellect and experience outside the country. Why would we want to be led by some egghead who wasted years in Oxford and Harvard when he could have been collecting shit on his boots in Alberta? Harper's sad lack of experience outside of Canada's West is played up as a virtue. A fat lot of good his having run a right-wing propaganda mill is when put up against a man with experience in the real world, but it may play to the mouth breathers who vote, who sway elections. Harper's focus group see Ignatieff as being vulnerable on the issue of crime. Funny thing, but I recall it was one issue that catapulted one Adolf Hitler to power, but never mind. While attacking the faint hope clause in life sentences, a loophole almost never used, and proposing mandatory sentences, he's quietly cut funding for prosecutors and the courts, which are necessary to bring criminals to justice. Tories are focusing on the liberals as a tax and spend party. Well, looky here. Who's the man who promised to be fiscally responsible who's plunging Canada into a record deficit? No leader could have avoided deficit during a deep recession, but few would brag of fiscal probity at the same time but the Tories. Harper claims that Ignatieff would raise taxes after the elusive recovery is achieved. Bloody right. Any government will have to raise taxes to pay the interest on the terrifying debts we're racking up for future generations. It would be the height of irresponsibility to avoid increases, allowing an exponentially increasing debt to be passed on to posterity. All in all, we foresee a season of bullshit before the leaves fall. Head to the mountains, beach, or lake, and ignore these idiots or risk your sanity. Canadian Brigadier General Jonathan Vance stated, IEDs are the tools of cowards. This observation came forth after a member of his convoy was killed by what our military calls an improvised explosive device, a mine to the rest of us, in Afghanistan. This was an interesting comment to come from a man who rode in what was described as an armored vehicle, while the dead corporal was in an LAV, or light armored vehicle. Meanwhile, the brave general, according to a newspaper article, surrounded himself with some of Canada's most battle-hardened veterans to guard him. As is common in the military, the general's bodyguards are called by a euphemism, in this case, force protection. Meanwhile, enemy combatants, terrorists, whatever, risk their lives to plant roadside bombs to attack convoys of foreign invaders. They risk detection in their chores by the most sophisticated electronics our military can muster. If discovered in their task, they and those around them will be unceremoniously and remotely killed. Planting mines is not for the faint of heart. In an asymmetrical war where one side has all the modern weaponry and the other has old rifles, booby traps, and disorganized forces, it would appear that those daring to oppose the invader are not cowards. I'll tell you who are the greatest cowards in this war against Afghanistan. These are the men safely ensconced in the United States who remotely operate the Predator drones, the same pilotless planes that will fly on Canada's border under American control. These drones are armed with missiles launched at suspected targets in Afghanistan and Pakistan. They have a remarkable record of hitting wedding parties, private homes, and similar targets. The cowards pushing the buttons in Virginia, Iowa, or other combat zone need never say they're sorry for the ensuing collateral damage. They just go home to bounce their children on a knee before eating a hot meal and watching a little TV. Senator John McCain, former Democratic candidate for U.S. president, was this kind of hero. He flew his jet plane over Vietnam, raining death on fighters and peasants alike, before returning to his base for relaxation and entertainment, entitled to an officer of the U.S. Air Force. He did this repeatedly, killing he knew not how many Vietnamese, before some spoil sport shot him down and took him prisoner. He suffered captivity for years before being released. Poor John underwent terrible privations for which he was given medals. His unseen victims received no medals when they were blown apart, eviscerated, and incinerated. John McCain and General Vance are what we consider heroes these days, while those who fight invaders with homemade weapons are cowards. Those of you who don't carefully read your May 23rd edition of the Economic and Political Weekly out of Mumbai may have missed the article, Communal Riots in Jamshedpur. During the 1979 religious riots in that province, the article declares, a most horrific incident that occurred during these riots would be seared into the memories of those present. This was the burning of an ambulance full of women and children. About 60 were inside this vehicle, a part of a caravan of vehicles carrying Muslims from the besieged Balabasa area to safety. Unquote. Horrible as religious-inspired riots can be, it's hard to imagine the terror of this incident. What is equally beyond imagination is how two regular busloads of people could have been packed or stacked within an ambulance. It makes the feat of circus clowns spilling from a tiny car seem mundane. In Afghanistan, nearly 40 years ago, I saw how those people could pack a car. An old car, invariably a Chevy, when contained so many that one could not see through the vehicle for bodies. The trunk would be propped open with a stick, and uncountable numbers of legs hung over the rear bumper. In Nicaragua, we saw a bus so packed that the last passenger had to be hoisted through a window, but Nicaraguans are pikers who would never win an ambulance packing contest against Indians. Back in BC, where ambulances run comparatively empty, scandals continue to ripple forth. We found that the Ministry of Children and Family Development hired a consultant for part-time work without going through the niceties of competitive bidding, as required for law for contracts above $25,000. He was called an ad hoc legal counsel, advising government on yet another reorganization of that chaotic ministry. He was not hired on contract as is normal procedure, but his hiring was called a secondment. This term is usually reserved for individuals temporarily moved from one government position to another. But this man, Brent Parfit, ran a one-man consulting company as a private individual. His expertise was so rare that ministry experts considered a rate of $275 per hour to be in line with his rare talents. Over the course of 2 years, between 2006 and 2008, he took home over $176,000 of our money. There's another case where the attitude of Campbell's liberal regime is, we don't have to follow laws and rules. We're the government. As we celebrated Canada Day, the 142nd anniversary of our independence and sovereignty, such as it is with a foreigner as nominal head of state, we had our collective nose rubbed in the reality of how limited is that sovereignty. A commercial airline flight from Fredericton to Montreal was turned back by American authorities as it carried one Adil Charcoti, a Canadian landed immigrant from Morocco. This man was arrested by CSIS in 2003 as an alleged Al-Qaeda sympathizer. Sympathizer, not a member or supporter, but sympathizer. This implies a state of mind, and arresting someone for a state of mind is Orwellian in the extreme. Perhaps our police should be investigating those who sympathize with the man who assassinated Dr. Teller, the abortion provider. That would keep our jails packed with fanatical fundamentalists who quietly cheered the death of that doctor performing perfectly legal medical operations. We could incarcerate those in the Dawson Creek area who secretly support the idea of bombing installations pumping poison gas through their community. There are lots of candidates out there, perhaps a majority, who sympathize with one illegal thing or another, but we don't slap them into irons for their beliefs as long as they're not manifested in actions. Beside this issue of a state of mind, there's a surrender of Canadian sovereignty when we're forced to submit detailed information on passengers of planes passing briefly through American airspace. Do we require such of passengers on American planes flying the Great Circle route over Canada to Europe? Maybe it's time that we did. Then we could arbitrarily force the odd plane to turn back if it carried someone we might class as a war criminal, perhaps. Prohibit any functionary of the former Bush regime from flying over our country, and we'd soon see the end of Americans vetting passengers flying between Canadian cities. Thus endeth the 318th edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia.